But we need to talk about being a friend to Jesus, because I don't think there's anything more important that we could spend our time with than learning how to be a friend to Jesus. Just like in our discipleship series, and I made this point, we had 5 lessons on discipleship, and I made the point over and over again that there's lots of people who will say, I'm a Christian, but are you a disciple? And so I'll modify that for this morning, and I'll say, you may be telling me, I'm a Christian, but are you a friend of God? Because that's really, really what a great question needs to be. James chapter 4, verse 4. I've asked you to turn there. James chapter 4, verse 4. James starts out very harshly, adulterers and adulteresses. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So all I'm going to do is take that and reverse it. So someone who wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So what does it mean to make yourself a friend of God? It's easy. You've got to make yourself an enemy of the world. You've got to get rid of worldliness. And that's actually what we're going to discuss this morning. Now, the idea of being a friend of God, I can't keep going without talking about that just for a second. This expression comes from James chapter 2, verse 23. Because it's talking about Abraham who did the will of God. And in James chapter 2, he's talking about when he offered his son Isaac. And he became the friend of God. Because his faith compelled him. It moved him to act. In Hebrews chapter 11, there's 2 instances where the Hebrew writer explicitly talks about Abraham doing something by faith. The first time was him moving around throughout the country of Canaan, leaving his own country and going by direction of God. He did that by faith. And the second one was offering Isaac. He did that by faith. When he did that, it made him the friend of God. And I want to hasten to add, because just a few weeks ago, we talked about lying. We talked about putting away lying. We took that from the case of the New York congressman, which I told you it would just get stranger, and it did. I'll let you read that on your own. It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. But we use that as the basis to put off lying, and we talked about Abraham 2 times, once in Egypt and once in Gerar. Lied. Got in a pretty good, decent amount of trouble because of it. But he always came back to God. So no matter what was in Abraham's life, no matter the missteps, the wrong decisions that he made, he always came back to God. That made him a friend of God. This morning, us removing worldliness is going to make us a friend of God. So in looking at that, we're going to talk about what it is. I'm going to define worldliness, and it's interesting, we use these in our prayers all the time. Rodney used the term worldly in his prayer this morning. So let's talk about it just for a second. I'm going to give you some biblical principles, some guiding principles, and these are biblical principles that tell us our relationship with the world. And then finally, we'll just kind of sum up by talking about why God wants us to get rid of worldliness. What is it that makes it so bad? Why do I need to make myself, and I'll use 2 words here, eminently spiritual. Eminently spiritual. That's the goal of what we look at this morning. We want to get rid of worldliness. But let's get started and let's talk about the fact of just what is it? What is it? Worldliness can be defined as the overemphasis of the world in your life. The overemphasis, and I need to emphasize that word because it is key, the overemphasis of the world in your life. Too worried about the pursuit of what's physical and material, whether it is a material possession, whether it's a secular interest or a secular pursuit. It's pursuing after that. To the exclusion, to the point where it's basically not letting you serve God the way that you should. That is, in a nutshell, worldliness. And worldliness is most definitely deceiving. Hebrews chapter 11, when it remarks about the fact of Moses. Moses was willing, because he identified himself with the people of God, Moses was willing to take a pass on the passing pleasures of sin. And worldliness, that frame of mind that then is going to manifest itself in the way that your life is lived, that frame of mind is going to produce what you think is going to be a lot of fun. But Hebrews chapter 11, and specifically in that 25th verse, it is the passing pleasures of sin. It is not what it appears to be. One of the funniest things, and a lot of people probably at some point in time have experienced this, but you can really, really experience it in the desert because of temperature differentials, but you can experience it in non-desert places, the mirage. And you look off into the landscape, and if you had to swear on a court of law, declaring what you are standing there and witnessing and seeing, you would say that in this photograph, I'm seeing a body of water between where I am and those mountains in the distance. But what is it? It's a mirage caused by temperature differentials. It looks like one thing, and you are so convinced that it's that thing. But in reality, it's something else. And guys, I don't know of any better way to kind of summarize worldliness. What it looks like is really, really great. What you end up with is something not so great. But I want to make sure that before we kind of move on from this point, that we do understand very, very carefully that worldliness is not just a physical manifestation. It's a heart problem. It's a mind problem. That's where it begins. And there's two different ways to think about this. We could be people who can be in the worst of situations, in the most sinfulest of places. Now, of course, I'm not encouraging you to do that. But we can be people who can be in the most sinfulest of situations and we can't wait to get out of it. I think maybe that's a small description of Lot. Look in 2 Peter chapter 2. Look in 2 Peter chapter 2. When we look in 2 Peter chapter 2 and we start reading in verse 6 about Lot. For example, about Lot, it says, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. And delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. We might be tempted to think, well, if Lot lived there, he wasn't very righteous. No, well, the Bible says he was righteous. Or if Lot lived there and he was really righteous, he would have wanted to get away. Well, he didn't want to get away, actually. He had to have help. But even the Bible calls him righteous. So I understand that I may be in situations and I might be in circumstances where I want to do nothing but get away from, because I understand it's not a good place to be. But I also want you to think about the reverse of it. I can be in, let me use my two words again, an eminently spiritual setting, like in this very room. And my mind can be miles away. So yes, worldliness does have a physical manifestation. We'll talk about that. But it really, truly begins in the heart. I can be in a wicked place and be a righteous person and want to get away from it and get away from it. But I can also be a person who's in a spiritual place. And my mind's worldly. It's not spiritual. And definitely, if it's the second case that we're talking about this morning, we want to make sure that we learn how to renew our mind into something that is truly, eminently spiritual. You want to be a friend to God, we've got to conquer the world. So how do we do it? This is most definitely not a issue that's untouched in the New Testament. No, it's actually touched quite a bit. I've just got five principles that I want to show you this morning just for the sake of time. Let's go to 1 John chapter 2. In 1 John chapter 2, and we're going to look in verses 15 and 16. Again, for a Bible student, they're pretty familiar. 1 John chapter 2, and we're going to read 15 and 16. Do not love the world. That's the same way of saying don't be worldly. Don't let worldliness into your life. Don't love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, and this is what I want to bring up, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. One of the great aspects of the Bible is that in such a short period of time, it's able to give us so much profound information. So to teach me about the nature of sin, John breaks it down into three areas. The lust of the flesh, things that we crave, that we really heavily want and desire, even if those things are wrong. What we see. Now, Achan saw the gold that they took from Ai. He coveted after it. That's the lust of the eyes. And then the pride of life. The pride of life can really be anything that elevates us above our station. Our true station is to be people who are humble, certainly humble as far as God's concerned, and being submissive to God, deferring to Him, willing to let Him direct us, and then even being submissive and humble to each other, looking out for others' interest, doing what we can to help one another, to build one another up. So the pride of life takes that and it elevates it into something that's wrong, into something that's ungodly. So the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, all three of these are demonstrated in Adam and Eve's temptation in Genesis chapter 3. They're demonstrated in Matthew chapter 4, in Luke chapter 4, when Jesus was tempted by the devil. Lord overcame them. We can overcome them. We've got to learn how not to be worldly people. Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. If I kind of take these three sins and we consolidate them just simply back down into the sin of worldliness, then let's kind of think about the fact that a lot of people just want to kind of throw their arms around the world. They want to be buddies with the world. They want to walk hand in hand down the street with the world. But here's what Jesus said. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and will despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. An old expression for riches. We'll bring riches up here in just a moment, because that does play a part in worldliness, a pretty big part in some people's lives, so we need to talk about it. But you cannot be a dual serving purpose. That's one of the dangers of worldliness. It looks like and it feels like and we act like we can do them both. But you can't. The solution is Colossians chapter 3, verse 2. Again, a solution that we can posit many times during the lesson. Colossians chapter 3 in the second verse, where it just says, set your mind on things above, not on the things of the earth. Why? Because the things of the earth are going to lead us back to lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Second principle that we want to discuss. Second principle, let's go to Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Second principle, Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Again, all of these principles that relate to worldliness. We can't conform to the world. So Romans chapter 12, starting in verse 1, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to the world, be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So just conforming means that I'm going to act in a certain way, and that certain way is I'm acting in agreement with the world. Acting in agreement with the world. Now that has some practical ramifications. Because if I do something that's in conformity with the world, but that's actually against the will of God, let's kind of keep the same language that Romans 12 uses. And if I, for example, use one of these excuses. Everybody's doing it. All the people in my, all my classmates, all of my friend circle, they're all doing it. All the people at work are doing it. Super Bowl pool. Everybody's throwing in, everybody's doing it. I'd look like a moron if I didn't join in. I'm just doing what feels good. I'm just trying to get along with everybody. It doesn't hurt anyone. It's really not so bad. A Christian isn't to conform. The whole point of Peter's letters, you know, Peter, we talked about Peter last week. If anyone knew conformity to the world, Peter did. And once he learned that lesson of non-conformity to the world, then he goes and he writes about it. Look in 1 Peter. And I just want you to notice 1 Peter chapter 2. And looking in verse 12, Peter, much later in his life, as he grew, as he matured, just like everyone does, he starts to exhort Christians. Look, you can't conform to the world. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 12, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, you're a good person, you have good works, you're not conformed to the world, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. Or we can look a little bit further. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 4, looking in 1 and 2. So go a couple of chapters later, 1 Peter 4, 1 and 2. Therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind, for he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of man, but for the will of God. A lot of people try to love the world. They try to conform to the world. Demas left Paul because Paul explicitly said in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 10, he loved this present world. Guys, everyone has a decision that they've got to make. And sometimes the decision of not loving the world, not being conformed to the world, it has some consequences. And here's what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5. You know, if you're thinking about the fact that everybody's doing it, or I'm going to be persecuted, people are going to look down on, people are going to ridicule me or mock me. Look at this in Matthew chapter 5, verses 10 through 12. Now, especially younger people, get this in your heart. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. That means being persecuted as people who can stand up for the will of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Expect it, but don't allow it. Don't allow it to let you conform to the world. That's being worldly. A third principle. Third principle. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 13, verse 22. I told you that we needed to talk about wealth. We needed to talk about riches because it is, again, so closely tied with a lot of people's conception of worldliness. So Matthew 13 and verse 22. Here Jesus says, "Now he who scattered seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful." So we've talked a little bit about the cares of the world. We'll talk just a little bit more about them. But let's look about this deceitfulness of riches. There's a huge danger of being worldly when we put all that preoccupation on materialism. So here's what Paul said, 1 Timothy chapter 6. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, and it is a good, good lesson for everyone to learn. 1 Timothy chapter 6, and we're going to note in verse 7 first. 1 Timothy chapter 6, looking in verse 7 to begin with. "For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain that we can carry nothing out. Verse 10, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness, and they pierce themselves through with many sorrows. But then look in verse 17, because there Paul says, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. In thinking about the last phrase, who's given us all things to enjoy. And I've mentioned before, God gave us our lives to enjoy. He gave us what we have to enjoy it. There's nothing wrong with us making a living. There's nothing wrong with hard work. There's nothing wrong with being rewarded for hard work. People in the Bible were rewarded for their hard work. What we want to make sure that we warn against and that we guard against is that we don't let the fruits of all of that drive us away from serving God, because that's really where the true temptation lies, is pushing us away from true faithful service to God. Now, it doesn't always happen. I've met Christians who are very, very wealthy, and they've been some of the strongest, most faithful, most steadfast people that I've ever met. They are, unfortunately, exceptions to the rule, though. Money's powerful, and chasing after it is powerful. We become part of the world. Enjoy it, but don't let it pull you away from God. When you do, brethren, that's worldly. Let's look at another one. James chapter 1, verse 27. Let's look in James chapter 1, verse 27. Here James puts it a different way. It's still the same idea. It's still worldliness. But here's what James says in James chapter 1, verse 27. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble. So we care for one another. But I mainly want us to focus on the last part of it in this lesson. That is to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And that brings up all kinds of really neat imagery. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 27. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 27. This kind of imagery is taken from the Old Testament. So we've been having our marriage class in the back. That's now finished. So I'm going to start this class in this auditorium in just a few minutes. And we're going to begin looking at from the tabernacle to the temple. From the tabernacle to the temple. And it's not just Solomon's temple. It's the temple of the Lord's church. And so all of this imagery that was taken back in the Old Testament and developed in the Old Testament for God's people to use is now morphing into a spiritual application for all of us. One example is that when you offered a lamb back in the Old Testament, you offered it without blemish. It was something perfect. It was something pure. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 27, I've asked you to turn there. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 27, that He might present her to Himself, a glorious church, having not spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she should be holy and without blemish. And we actually discussed last Sunday morning what a church does. If it has members and those members, in evaluating their faithfulness, they are not without spot or blemish. The command for the Lord's people is to withdraw yourselves from them. So we have to take keeping ourselves unspotted from the world very, very seriously. I think there's a reasonable case to be made that virtually all sin has its root in worldliness. And again, the strong case that I would make just goes back to 1 John chapter 2. Do not love the world, because here's what you find in the world: the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. And so what those do is they kind of then degenerate into all these different actions. And I've got a bunch of them in front of you. And there is a lot. Brethren, there's things that we can destroy. We can destroy them with strife and outbursts of wrath. We can do it through dissensions. We can do it through faction. We can do it through rude and unkind words. You know what? The Bible condemns all of that. There's what we think. What we think in the mind. Covetousness. We just talked about materialism. Covetousness. Laziness, pride, anger, hatred, selfish ambition, envy and jealousy. What does the New Testament do? It condemns all of those in trying to keep people unspotted from the world. There is what we do. What we do. Several illustrations of this with, and again, it's just a summary. I don't claim that I know all of the things that we can do, but abortion, drunkenness, social drinking, dancing, gambling, homosexuality, immodest dress, pornography, sexual immorality, tobacco, substance abuse, all of that wrapped into what people can do. And again, I don't claim that I've even captured all of it. Then there's what we can say. Profanity, all kinds of other inappropriate language. There's lying, there's gossip, there's slander, there's all kinds of things. So look at all this whole gamut, and even again, the whole gamut of what I haven't been able to capture. But all of this is representative of things that we can do and say and think and tear down. Keeping someone unspotted from the world means that I'm going to get away from all of this stuff. And again, furthermore, to add to it one more time, even if I do conquer all of this, we all struggle with one or more of these throughout our lives, believe me. But then I also have to make sure that all of the good things, the useful, helpful things in life, like work and school and entertainment and my recreation and all of that stuff, that it doesn't get in the way of me being faithful, devoted, godly, righteous, and unspotted from the world. Got to get the worldliness out. We've got to be a friend to God. And being a friend of God means that we come to conquer these. That we learn how to put them to death, as Paul very eloquently but very sharply said in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. One more principle in this section. One more principle. Let's go to Titus chapter 2 and verses 11 and 12. So that one was a little more negative, so let's consider one positive. Titus chapter 2, looking in verses 11 and 12. Titus chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men. You know, we love thinking about grace. We love contemplating grace. I don't know of anyone who doesn't. But again, there's practical ramifications of that. Because in the 12th verse, that it teaches us to deny ungodliness and worldly lust, and positively lets us live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age. And we are so thankful or the Scriptures, who tell us about people like Noah and Lot and Abraham. They tell us about Joseph. They tell us about Peter, about Paul. All of these people who you could pick something out of every one of their lives and it would be rough. Depending on which person you picked, some of it would be really, really rough. But these were still godly, righteous people because every time they got away from God, they came back. They came back. So I'm not up here this morning preaching about you achieving perfection. I'm up here preaching this morning about you achieving faithfulness. And faithfulness means that when you turn from the Lord, you're going to come back. What is sound preaching? A little hint, but you still got to be here tonight. It's going to be preaching that directs people back to God. That's what it is. I love this illustration. I think the illustration, as it were, may have come over on the Mayflower, which is good because it talks about the fact that ships ships on the water turn out to be extremely helpful. Extremely helpful. Not very good when you let the water get in the ship. In a like manner, or a child of God, a child of God has so much potential. They have so much power as they live in the world. But what happens when they let the world start living in them? They sink. I can remember back, as far back as my age in my mind lets me remember, hearing illustrations and such in sermons, I remember the ship in the water. It's classic. It'll never die because it's so good. Five biblical principles that we need to live by and that we need to understand. So, let's kind of close out. Why does God want us not to be worldly? Why does God not want us not to be worldly? Four quick reasons. Number one, it's incompatible with the love of God. Mankind will love something. Mankind will love something. It's what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. No man can serve two masters. He's going to love one, and he'll hate the other one, or he'll hate one, he'll love the other one. Mankind's going to love something. Matthew chapter 22, verse 37, God wants us to love Him in every conceivable way, from every possible angle. And that means not being driven by the world. Secondly, the world and the lusts aren't going to last. Let's go back to 1 John chapter 2, verse 17, because this one is most definitely worth reading. 1 John chapter 2, now we're going to look in verse 17. Of course, remember that we read 15 and 16, but now when we look in 17, and the world is passing away, and the lust of it. So everything that you desire in the world, again, some of it might be bad, but some of it might be fine. But it doesn't matter, because John's point is, all of it is one day going to be gone. One day it's going to be gone. So brethren, everyone's got decisions to make. And we're here to urge, we're here to advocate for us making decisions that's going to lead us to imminent spirituality, that's going to lead us to godliness and away from the direction of worldliness. Because that's what being a friend of God means. God also wants us to get rid of worldliness. Third, because God knows how to enjoy life. God knows how to enjoy life. God gave us the guideway, the Scriptures, in order for us to know how to live life, for us to enjoy life, for us to have, as Jesus so properly put it, an abundant life. Look with me in Revelation chapter 22 and verse 14. In Revelation chapter 22 and verse 14, sometimes being a child of God, because the world gets to frame it, which is not a good idea, but nevertheless, because the world gets to frame it, the world wants to frame being a child of God as just nothing but a life of deprivation, a life of having to say no, a life of not getting to do what you want, a life of being ridiculed because you're so different. But the Bible says something different. Revelation chapter 22, verse 14. Blessed are those who do His commandments. And those commandments that we see in 1 John chapter 5 in the third verse, number one, are not burdensome. But also we need to remember that enjoying life is not inherently sinful. We brought up some ways and some illustrations here throughout the lesson. Enjoying life is not inherently sinful. But blessed are those who do His commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the gates of the city. Doing God's will is going to be worth that. Doing God's will is going to be worth that. But one more reason. Let me leave you with this one. God's perspective is a whole lot better than ours. So 1 Peter chapter 1 in verses 24 and 25, and let me show you what I mean by this. 1 Peter chapter 1 and reading 24 and 25. Here again is what Peter writes, taking from the Old Testament, all flesh is as grass, from Isaiah. All flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man as the flower of grass. The grass withers, the flower fades away, but the word of the Lord endures forever. Now this is the word by which the gospel was preached to you. So that gospel is telling me that I need Jesus Christ. That gospel is explaining to me how I can have a very rich, fulfilling, satisfying life. Now, not a life that's going to be without consequence or without ramification, because I'll tell you what, the world will make sure that's not the case. The devil will make absolutely sure that you're going to face persecution and you're going to face ridicule and you're going to face mockery for deciding to do what you do. But the word of the Lord abides forever, and that's the word, that's the gospel that's been preached to you. So you sum it all up. What is the whole conclusion of the matter? To fear God and do His will. Because there's going to be a day of judgment. One of the elements of sound preaching is the fact that there's going to be a day of reckoning. There's going to be a day when we answer to all of the ramifications of living in the world. Brethren, we just don't want to be of the world. Being a friend of God, just saying it, being a friend of God is such a warm and an inviting concept. I mean, who wouldn't think about being a friend of God? But again, it's got some really, really personal, deep ramifications to it. It means putting away the world. It means making sure that every direction that I go is going to go toward God. Toward, again, these two words that I'll use for the final time, imminent spirituality. So what is the trend of your life? As you put your life under the magnifying glass, which you need to, because one day it will be put under the magnifying glass. What do you see? What's the trend? Where are you going? Are you living a worldly life? Are you living a godly life? A righteous life? We want to help people find that positive route to be a friend of God. But in order to do it, you can't be worldly. And as we've talked about this morning, there's a lot to it. There's many components to it. But brethren, in living in a godly and a righteous way, we're going to be right before the Lord. So what we want to do is we want to encourage you. We're going to sing a song for your encouragement, that you may very well be here. And if you're here and you're thinking that, well, I'm here, I'm in the right place, I'm a religious person, better make sure your heart's there. Because if it's not, let's use this time to fix it. We've had our opportunity, we've had our invitation, and we pray now that you're going to respond to it. Please, as we stand and as we sing.